I'm here on a job site with Tim, who owns his own electrical contracting business.
Three employees and two work trucks.
Tim traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance. We're positively here where he needs us most.
They sure are.
With step-by-step help on all his insurance needs, all for shockingly low rates.
Shockingly low, huh?
Just a little bit of electrician humour. Do you get it?
I got it.
You know, it feels like we have a real connection. All right, I'll stop.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. It feels good to Geico.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Welcome to the Divergent Files podcast.
Power didn't start with a vote. It started with a story. Because what if the people running your life today are just the latest chapter in a control system that might be a whole lot older than we were taught? By the end of this episode, you're going to see that some of humanity's oldest written records don't read like clean history. They read more like instructions for who gets to rule. The other night, I was helping my kid with a history assignment. You know the one. Early humans lived in tribes, then they chose leaders, and then over time, leaders became chiefs, then kings. Nice, clean diagram. Cute little stick figures. Everybody slowly agreeing who's in charge. It's kind of like a group project that somehow didn't end in violence. But here's the part I didn't tell them. Most group projects don't end with consensus. They end with one person in charge and everyone else pretending that's fair. So he looks up at me and goes, "So people just decided to have kings?" And I had this stupid pause where I almost said, "Yeah, pretty much, because that's what we're taught." But instead, I just sat there staring at the school-approved cartoon, thinking about how adults still get ruled by people they never really picked, and we just call it normal life. But sitting in a museum in Oxford right now, there's a piece of baked clay about 8 inches tall. You could hold it in one hand and not think twice about it, until you realize what's carved into it. It's called the Weld Blundell Prism, and it contains a timeline that doesn't just stretch history, it breaks it. Because according to the text pressed into that clay, the first 8 kings of humanity didn't rule for decades, or even centuries. They ruled for a combined total of 241,200 years. And for some reason, it's always 8. Why not 7 or 9? So let that sit for a second. 241,000 years for 8 kings. That's longer than modern humans have even been around by most accepted models. And whoever carved that into clay didn't hesitate. There was no disclaimer. No, this is symbolic. Just, this is what happened. You find a city in Mesopotamia that shows up way too early and way too organized for the clean timeline we were handed. You get king lists with impossible lifespans, tied to cities that are absolutely real. You get these strange sages in Mesopotamian tradition, credited with bringing law, ritual, and basically the starter kit for civilization. And then you watch later rulers do what rulers always do, edit the past until the present looks legitimate. And if that sounds ancient, well, it shouldn't. Now, look, I'm not saying your HOA president is secretly a Sumerian demigod, but the chain of command we inherited sure feels older than we pretend it is. Your government, your boss, your whole idea of who gets to sit on the throne, and why you were told that's just how civilization works. So tonight, we're going into the clay document nobody talks about, the impossible kings before the flood, the helpers some people think were more than human, and the edits that may have turned memory into politics. And I'm not here to tell you what to believe. I'm here to show you the receipts and let you decide whether we invented kings or inherited the blueprint for them. Because if the oldest stories about power were never just symbolic, then the people who taught us how power works may not be who we think they were. And maybe the oldest conspiracy isn't about aliens or gods or giants. Maybe it's simpler than that. Maybe somebody rewrote the origin story of civilization, and we've been living by the rules ever since. So here's the part of human history nobody warned you about. One of the oldest surviving king lists we've ever found, older than the Bible, older than the whole idea of history class, straight up says kings didn't rise out of tribes. They came down from the sky. And I know that sounds like the setup to a bad Ancient Aliens rerun, but the document is very real, the translation is real, and the punchline is honestly insane. It's called the Sumerian King List, and unlike every neat, laminated school timeline you've ever seen, this thing reads like somebody handed the job of explaining civilization to a sleep-deprived cosmic accountant. It gives you cities, dynasties, whole chains of power, laid out like this is all perfectly normal. Except their version of a presidential term is this: Alulim ruled 28,800 years. That's 28,800 for one guy. Imagine your boss staying in charge long enough to watch continents rearrange. Then it keeps going. You get eight kings before the flood, and together they rack up 241,200 years of rule. Not a typo. 241,200. If you wrote that on a homework assignment today, a teacher would send you to the nurse for a concussion check. And just when the list is already completely off the rails, it drops the line that really matters. After the kingship descended from heaven, the kingship was Eridu. Now, that wording matters. Not that kingship slowly evolved. The text says it descended from heaven. Like, authority showed up pre-installed. And after that great flood in the text, the list starts up again with new rulers, shorter lifespans, and names that start overlapping with cities and kings the archaeological record actually recognizes. And here's where it stops being easy to laugh at, because that same list, the one claiming kings ruled for tens of thousands of years, eventually starts naming rulers we know were real, not legends, real kings, with inscriptions, with cities, with physical evidence in the ground. So now you've got a problem, because you can't just throw the whole thing out anymore. Which raises the question nobody likes sitting with. If the list is wrong, why does it become accurate later? Because people don't usually start telling the truth halfway through a lie. And if it's accurate later, then what exactly is going on in the part we've been calling myth? Because it starts reading less like pure myth and more like a memory somebody cleaned up. And here's the part mainstream archaeology usually mentions, and then quietly files it under myth, ritual memory, or dynastic propaganda. This wasn't one rogue tablet some farmer scribbled on. Copies of this thing have been found across Mesopotamia. Different versions, different cities, different time periods, like a political gospel that kept getting updated to match whoever was sitting on the throne. Same move you see now, just with better tools. You clean up the past, and the present starts looking inevitable. And if they were willing to adjust the story back then, what exactly made it through untouched? So if you boil the king list down to sixth grade clarity, here's what it's telling you. According to the text, power didn't start with us. At least not if you believe this text. According to the text, it was handed down from above. Then the flood hits. And the system starts again. And if that sounds insane, fine. But then ask yourself this: why does one of humanity's oldest surviving king traditions read less like a myth and more like an early version of a control system? Because if the Sumerian king list is just a myth, it's one hell of a detailed myth for something that keeps getting used to legitimize power. And if it's not, then everything we think we know about how humans learned to rule themselves might start with a cover story that got handed to us as history. Before we let the ancient world drag us into its 200,000-year fever dream, we need to stop for a second and talk about what this thing actually is. The Sumerian king list isn't some fringe relic that a guy named RavenWolf88 found on page 9 of Reddit. It's real. It's written in Sumerian. Pressed into clay by people who took this so seriously, they basically baked their political theology into tablets the size of bricks. Most surviving copies come from the 3rd dynasty of Ur and old Babylonian periods, when rewriting history wasn't some scandal. It was basically statecraft. You didn't like your past? Well, you updated it, and that was the move. Control the story and you control what people think is possible. The most complete version, the Weld Blundell Prism, is 4-sided clay column covered in neat rows of cuneiform, basically the ancient version of We Mean Business. Nobody scratches thousands of symbols into a clay pillar unless they think the world needs to remember every last mark. But here's the first thing scholars will tell you, sometimes out loud and sometimes through gritted teeth. The Sumerian King List is not a neutral history book. It's political theology with better handwriting. The CDLI describes it as a text used to reinforce political theology and ideology. Translated into modern English, it's basically saying, this is the order. Here's who gets to rule. Don't ask any questions. The ideology was simple. Only one city at a time gets to hold the right to rule all of Sumer. Not because of elections, not just because of war, because the list framed that rule as legitimate. If your city wasn't on the list, well, congratulations. You were now officially less important than the guy holding the clay. This thing wasn't just documenting power. It was there to help legitimize it. And if this is what survived, you have to wonder what didn't. Then the text hits a wall. No transition, just a line. The flood swept over the land. And we've actually found flood layers in Mesopotamia, thick enough to erase entire settlements. And everything changes. Before the flood, kings rule for tens of thousands of years. After the flood, those numbers collapse fast. 30,000 years becomes 1,000, then hundreds, then something that finally starts to look human. And the text says something even stranger. It doesn't say kingship continued. It says kingship had to descend from heaven again. So think about that. Not rebuilt, reinstalled. Like whatever system was running before the flood went offline, and whatever came back wasn't the same version. Which raises a quiet possibility that whatever came before wasn't just different. It might have been more advanced than what came after. And that's not neutral record keeping. That's a civilization drawing a line between two kinds of authority, one divine and one human. And then telling future generations which one came first. So don't let the clay fool you. In the versions that survived, this thing wasn't just claiming who ruled. It was claiming why they had the right to rule and who didn't. Before the flood, the world looked nothing like ours. At least if you trust the people who thought that dividing line was worth preserving. And the Sumerian King List doesn't ease you into that era. It kicks the door open and drops numbers so massive, they don't even pretend to fit inside human biology. It starts with Alulim of Eridu, the first king. His reign is given as 8 sars. That comes out to 28,800 years. Not 8 decades. 28,800. These reign lengths are not written like normal human reigns. They're built in giant sexagesimal units, base 60, because the Sumerians built their math around 60 like the whole universe ran on a clock and somehow they had the manual. Next comes Alaungar with 10 sars to his name. That's 36,000 years. Then more kings, each with reign lengths that feel like someone just kept holding down the zero key and nobody stepped in to stop it. And when you stack all of it, the antediluvian era, the world before the flood, comes out to this, 241,200 years. 8 rulers, same structure, no variation. 241,200 years. And the list does not present any of this like myth. There's no wink in the text, no apology, no little side note saying maybe this part is symbolic. It just lays the timeline down and leaves it there. Like, deal with it. But here's where it gets uncomfortable. The numbers are not random. They're not chaotic, and they are definitely not sloppy. This doesn't read like something some drunk scribe made up during a heat stroke. It's built on a base 60 system, sexagesimal. The values are clean. They divide cleanly. The whole thing locks together like gears inside a machine older than recorded history. And then when people start pulling the math apart, you hit the weird part. The math lines up. It maths. And you don't discover a 26,000-year cycle by accident. 241,200 drops right into the same kind of numerical architecture Mesopotamian cultures used when they were talking about massive cyclical spans of time. And then someone notices that the later Babylonian priest historian Berossus gives the pre-flood era as 432,000 years, another giant number built from the exact same mathematical toolkit. So different centuries, different versions of the same civilizational memory. Same numerical architecture underneath it. And that's where it stops feeling like the ancient world was just telling stories. It feels like they were preserving something, maybe encoding it, maybe passing it forward in a form they thought later people would still take seriously. And maybe it only makes sense if you understand time the way they did, not as a straight line, but as a cycle that resets itself. And that leaves one last possibility that sits right in the middle of all of this. Not proven, not dismissed, just sitting there. What if these early records aren't describing the beginning of civilization, but the aftermath of something earlier? A system that already existed, collapsed, and had to be rebuilt. Not perfectly, but from memory. Because early civilizations don't usually describe themselves as rebuilding something unless they think something was already there. Because when you read the King List that way, it stops sounding like a myth about origins and starts sounding like a document trying to preserve continuity after a break. So now you're left with a choice. Either the first scribes in recorded history were throwing around cosmic scale numbers because huge numbers sounded impressive, or they were trying to encode something they believed was real. Maybe a calendar or a cycle. Maybe some kind of countdown. Or maybe a memory of a world before ours and the one thing that destroyed it. And if that sounds like mythology, well, it gets worse when you realize it's not the only text saying it. If the Sumerian King List is the clay receipt, Eridu Genesis is the instruction manual. It's one of the oldest surviving Mesopotamian creation and flood texts we have. Older than the biblical flood story most people grew up with. Older than the cleaned up Sunday school version most people got handed later. And what it says is not subtle. In broad strokes, Eridu Genesis gives you the same sequence, like somebody was taking dictation from somewhere above the planet. Humans are created. Cities get founded. Kingship gets established. Then the gods decide to wipe everything out with a flood. Not developed, not something that slowly emerged over thousands of years. They say established. And the way the story frames it, that matters. Because kingship doesn't feel like something humans invented. It feels like something that got placed into the world. And when you get into the details, it gets even more blunt. The goddess Nintur, the divine mother figure, wants humans building cities and temples, and the imagery in the text is basically that the gods get to rest in their shade. So think about that. Humans aren't building cities for themselves. They're building infrastructure so the gods can sit back in the shade. Temples aren't just places of worship. They start sounding a lot more like divine real estate. And the story's logic is pretty blunt. The gods are the ones who decide when kingship appears, which cities rise, which cities fall, which humans get to sit on the throne and pretend they're in charge. This isn't mythology in the sense of once upon a time. This is mythology in the sense of here's how your operating system works. And once you accept that system, you don't question who's running it. And then you put Eridu Genesis next to the Sumerian king list, and the uncomfortable part is what happens next. They agree. And when two separate texts survive saying the same thing, you have to wonder how many others didn't. The king list says kingship descended from heaven. Eridu Genesis gives you the same basic claim. The gods established the first cities and installed the first order of rule. Different tablets, different scribes, different political uses, but the same claim. So, either multiple founding traditions in the same region kept landing on the same idea, that humans didn't invent civilization, they inherited it, or the people closest to the beginning were trying to preserve something we stopped listening to. Two texts from the same region, same deep memory under both of them, same basic blueprint, that humans didn't bootstrap their way out of the mud. According to some of the oldest surviving stories from Mesopotamia, they were handed the framework, which is a strange way for a civilization to describe itself, unless it believes something came before it.
Hi everyone, this is James and Dan. We are two-fourths of the hit UK podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. Every week we sit down behind some microphones and share with each other the best things we've found out over the last 7 days.
Yes, so for instance, Dan, did you know that you cannot tie a knot in four dimensions?
I knew that's where I was going wrong. Interesting.
There are all sorts of reasons why, but we would go into them all on our podcast, along with loads of extra facts as well.
That's right. And if you want to check it out, No Such Thing as a Fish is available wherever you get your podcasts.
Up to now, the story sounds wild enough. Cities appear too early. Kings rule for geological time spans. Civilization feels less invented and more installed. But the Sumerians didn't stop there. They added another layer, and this is the part that ought to make every modern mythologist pause for a second. Because according to the Mesopotamian tradition, the first kings weren't alone. They had handlers. The Apkallu, or the Apgal, if you want the Sumerian version, are usually presented as seven primeval sages tied to Enki, the god of wisdom and deep water. And the tradition does not describe them as normal wandering priests or holy men. Across Mesopotamian art and texts, they show up in forms that are anything but ordinary. Sometimes they are fish associated. Sometimes they are cloaked in fish skins. Sometimes, especially in later protective iconography, they're winged or bird linked. Whatever form they take, they read as other. And their job description is basically shockingly direct. Teach humanity civilization. Receive it. In the tradition, they're the ones bringing the civilizational toolkit. How to farm, how to write, how to build, how to order society. They're tied to the great early cities, Eridu, Ur, Nippur, Kish, Kulab, Lagash, Shurupak. Many of the same centers that keep reappearing in the king list tradition. And if you zoom out far enough, you start seeing where some of the more controversial interpretations come from. Because in Sumerian tradition, the authority behind kingship was often tied to the Anunnaki, not as cartoon gods in the sky, but as the source of order itself. The ones who establish cities, define rule, set structure. Now, whether you take that literally or as mythologized memory, it's up to you. But the pattern is there. Power doesn't originate with humans. It's handed to them. So now the pattern starts getting harder to ignore. Kings aren't self-made, cities don't rise organically, and civilization starts looking like a package deal delivered with customer support. But here's the part mainstream treatments almost always glide past. A separate scholarly text from Uruk, often called the Uruk list of kings and sages, doesn't just preserve the memory of antediluvian rulers. It pairs primeval kings with primeval sages. Seven kings paired with seven Apkallu. And if that pairing shows up this clean, you have to ask how much of the system didn't survive in the record. A ruler and a corresponding sage, a king up front, and a consultant standing just behind the curtain. That's not just mythology anymore. It starts looking a whole lot less like myth and a whole lot more like political hierarchy. A two-tiered system, human authority out front, and something more than human running in the back. Visible leadership and something less visible shaping it. So now you can start to see the structure. Before the flood, power isn't just centralized, it's layered. And this is where it starts getting uncomfortable for a few other reasons too. A number of scholars see a strong line of influence between the Mesopotamian Apkallu tradition and the later Jewish watchers in the Book of Enoch. The beings who descend, teach forbidden knowledge, and help push the world toward catastrophe. Same role, same pre-flood structure, same civilizational acceleration with disaster hanging over the whole thing. Which is a strange coincidence, unless different cultures were describing the same underlying idea in different languages. Non-human or not quite human beings descend. They teach humanity things it may not have been ready for. Civilization surges forward, then everything collapses. So, before the flood, kings weren't just kings, they were frontmen. And behind them stood a roster of beings cast as more than human, whose job was to build the world and maybe teach humans how to obey the system that came with it. By now, you've heard the headline version. Ancient kings lived for tens of thousands of years. That's the part everyone laughs at, and honestly, fair enough. But the real story isn't the size of the numbers, it's how they behave. Because exaggeration is usually sloppy. These numbers are not. The Sumerians built a lot of their math around 60, not 10. A base 60 system called sexagesimal. Your clock still uses it. Your circles still use it. You're still living inside their math whether you like it or not. So when the king list says the pre-flood kings ruled for 241,200 years, that doesn't read like random mythic inflation. It reads like structure. It drops right into the same kind of numerical structure Mesopotamian scribes were already using for very large values. Not fuzzy or poetic, precise. That's not usually how random exaggeration behaves. That's how systems behave. And then history does something uncomfortable. Centuries later, a Babylonian priest named Berossus writes that pre-flood kings ruled for 432,000 years. Different era, same Mesopotamian math underneath it. Because 432,000 is another giant number built from the same toolkit, same numerical language. So now you're not looking at random exaggeration anymore, because you don't map cycles that long by accident. You're looking at consistency across time. And that forces a quieter question. What if those reigns weren't lifespans at all? What if they were markers, cycles, encoded periods tied to astronomy, calendars, or resets the scribes understood but never bothered explaining to us? At that point, the numbers stop reading like fantasy and start reading more like a ledger. So maybe no king ever lived for 36,000 years, but maybe the people recording those reigns were tracking something bigger than a man. Something bigger than a dynasty. Because civilizations don't usually start by tracking cycles they haven't lived long enough to observe. Writing history in cosmic math is not primitive behavior. That's a system. And if power was measured this way, then it wasn't just about who ruled. It was about how long the system itself stayed in control. So it raises the question no one wants to sit with. Who taught the earliest city builders to measure power using the same math they used to measure the sky? By now, you've probably realized something. The Sumerian king list doesn't read like a history book. It reads like a verdict. And if you want proof, you don't even need aliens, gods, or floods. You just need to compare copies. Because there isn't one Sumerian king list. There are versions, copied on multiple tablets by multiple scribes in multiple cities. And when scholars line them up side by side, the list starts doing something historians hate. It doesn't agree with itself. Names shift, reign lengths change, and dynasties get merged, split, shortened, or stretched. Some rulers appear in one recession and disappear in another, like they've been written out of the frame. And that's when you realize what you're actually holding. Not the past, a curated past, a past with edits. And this isn't subtle either. Scholars have long noted that major powers you'd expect to matter in a document like this are conspicuously sidelined or absent from the story it wants to tell. Not in a we haven't found them yet way, not in a maybe they were minor way, missing like somebody made a choice. Which brings us to the first really obvious omission, Lagash. Lagash wasn't a footnote city. It was a major power, a real city-state with real rulers, real inscriptions, and real economic muscle. And yet, the early rulers of Lagash are suspiciously absent from the version of the king list that became the official tradition. A city that mattered enough to leave a heavy archaeological footprint gets treated like it never really belonged in the official line of legitimacy. That doesn't look accidental. That looks like a history document doing political work. And it's not just Lagash. Larsa gets a similar treatment. Important, intellectual, a real player in the region. And yet, it never gets the kind of place in the list's legitimacy chain you'd expect. So, what the heck do we have here? A king list that claims to track legitimate rule across Mesopotamia while quietly sidelining cities that were inconvenient to the story of legitimacy. Which tells you what the list really is. It's not cataloging who ruled, it's deciding who counts. It's building the illusion that power has always flowed in one clean, uninterrupted line. And then you get to the really telling detail. The list can't even keep its own numbers straight. Take the Gutian dynasty. In one recension, the tradition gives one total for the number of kings. In another, the names don't quite match the count. One version points toward 21. Another effectively lands on 20. So, what happened to the missing king? Did he get lost? Or did somebody quietly drop him because he didn't fit the version of history the next regime wanted pressed into clay? Because inconvenient facts don't disappear on their own. So, here's what people don't want to admit. We think history gets rewritten in modern times only, through media, through textbooks, or politics. But it's the same move 4,000 years ago, pressed into wet clay while it was still soft enough to reshape. Different tools, same instinct. So if one of the oldest political histories we have is already playing favorites, sidelining cities, and reshaping the record, what else got cut before you ever heard the story? Up to this point, the Sumerian king list feels strange, ancient, almost cosmic. But now we pull the curtain back, because this thing didn't survive thousands of years just because it was interesting. It survived because it was useful, like really useful. After the collapse of the third Ur dynasty, Mesopotamia didn't politely agree on who was in charge next. Power fractured and cities competed. Everybody had a claim and nobody had a receipt. Enter Isin. Isin wasn't the biggest city. It wasn't the oldest, but it had something far more effective than an army. It had a story. The rulers of Isin clearly positioned themselves as the legitimate inheritors of the kingship from Ur, not by conquest, not even by election, but by continuity. And the king list was one of the cleanest tools for making that case. Because the list is built around the very specific doctrine, only one city at a time holds true kingship. Not shared or debated, transferred. Like a crown that only one city gets to wear at a time. So instead of a messy overlap, the list forces everything into one clean line. And somehow, it always seems to land exactly where the current regime needs it to. If your city appeared next in the sequence, well, congratulations. You weren't just powerful, you were approved. if your city didn't, you might as well not exist. This wasn't loud propaganda. That's what made it dangerous. There were no speeches or manifestos. Just a clay document calmly implying, this is how it has always been. And that's the real trick. Once you convince people that power moves in a straight, divinely sanctioned line, you don't need to argue anymore. You just point at the list, and in plain English, it's brutally simple. If your city is in the list, you are God-approved. If you're not, well, you're a footnote. And here's the part that should feel uncomfortably familiar. This is the same move official histories have been making ever since. They don't just record power, they tidy it up. They smooth over the messy transitions, bury the inconvenient challengers, and turn chaos into inevitability. Control the past and the present starts looking pre-approved. The Sumerian king list isn't just interesting because it's old. It's special because it's one of the earliest times we can see the trick this clearly. Power didn't just win wars, it won the story about the wars. So when you read the Sumerian king list, you're not just reading who ruled, you're reading who won the narrative war and who got written out of it. By now, the Sumerian king list isn't standing alone anymore. It's part of a chorus. Different languages, different gods, and different centuries, but the same story. So let's strip it down to the bones. In the king list, history starts twice. First, kings rule for impossible lengths of time, and power feels, well, not human. But then everything stops. You have a flood. After that, kings return, lifespans shrink, and history starts looking recognizable again. That alone would be weird. But then you open Eridu Genesis and realize the same structure is staring back at you. Humans are created, cities are founded, kingship is installed. Then a divine council decides humanity is getting too loud and too chaotic and too hard to manage, so they reset the board. One man, Zeusudra, is warned and he builds a boat. The world floods and civilization barely hangs on. You fast forward, and the flood tradition embedded in the Epic of Gilgamesh hits the same beat. Utnapishtim instead of Zeusudra. Same boat, same storm, same eerie calm afterward. Then you hit the Bible. Noah, the Ark, the flood, the reboot. And at this point, anyone still saying, well, coincidence, is working very hard for it. Because patterns this consistent don't usually survive by accident. But it doesn't stop there. A Babylonian priest named Berossus, writing in the 3rd century BC, lays out his own version of pre-flood history. Absurdly long-lived kings, a catastrophic flood, a reset of humanity. A later source, same structure. And here's the thing that should quietly bother you. No, that doesn't mean every version is independent. But even after you account for that, the pattern is still hard to ignore. You keep landing on the same bones. A world before the flood that already looks like it had a system. Not primitive or experimental, it was functional. Rulers who don't feel entirely human. A disaster big enough to end an age. A chosen survivor, and then history starting over. And with it, a new version of who gets to rule. At some point, that stops feeling like simple myth building and starts feeling a whole lot more like memory compression. And this is where science starts clearing its throat, not barging in or making claims, just raising an eyebrow. Geologists talk about the Younger Dryas, a violent period of climate chaos near the end of the last ice age, with sudden cooling, massive flooding from melting ice sheets, and sea levels rising over generations until coastlines people once lived on were simply gone. No gods were required and no sermons, just catastrophe. So imagine this, early civilizations don't remember dates, they remember terror, they remember the sky breaking, the water rising, the old world disappearing. And over generations, that memory hardens into story. The gods arguing, giants falling, kings losing power, history starting over. So when so many of humanity's oldest stories keep circling back to gods, strange rulers, catastrophe, and a reset, at some point, you stop asking who copied who, and you start asking what they were all trying to remember. And, more importantly, who needed that memory rewritten?
Hi everyone, this is James and Dan. We are two-fourths of the hit UK podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. Every week we sit down behind some microphones and share with each other the best things we've found out over the last 7 days.
Yes, so for instance, Dan, did you know that you cannot tie a knot in four dimensions?
I knew that's where I was going wrong. Interesting.
There are all sorts of reasons why, but we would go into them all on our podcast, along with loads of extra facts as well.
That's right. And if you want to check it out, No Such Thing as a Fish is available wherever you get your podcasts.
At some point, every civilization has to answer the same question. Who gets to decide? And if you strip away the details, you keep running into two very different ways that old story gets told. The first one is the version we're taught in school. Nice, organic, comfortable. Small tribes, elders, consensus. A leader rises because people trust them. Bottom up, messy, but human. In that version, kings are basically just chieftains with better branding. But then there's the other version, and that's the one these early Mesopotamian texts keep quietly describing whether we like it or not. In this version, leadership doesn't really evolve. It shows up already built. Cities don't just slowly happen, they are founded. Temples don't feel improvised, they feel placed. And kingship? It doesn't emerge from debate, it gets handed down. The Sumerian king list doesn't even pretend otherwise. Kingship moves from city to city like a transferable asset. Eridu, Bad Tibira, Larak, Sippar, Shurupak. Then the flood hits, and after the reset, kingship resumes, this time starting at Kish, like the system rebooted and loaded the next save file. No elections or rebellion arc, just a transfer. The Eridu Genesis makes it even less subtle. The gods decide when cities appear. They decide when kingship begins. Humanity doesn't ask for it, it just shows up. And then there's the Apkallu layer, the part that really starts messing with the tidy slow evolution story. These semi-divine beings aren't just teaching humans how to survive. They are teaching them how to organize, how to build, how to calculate and administer, how to rule. That's not cultural drift, that's onboarding. So if you take these texts at face value, not literally, but structurally, what they describe isn't humanity slowly figuring leadership out. They describe humanity being handed a governance system. And that's where the modern echo starts getting a little too loud. Because once authority is framed as something that comes from above, from gods and heaven, from destiny, experts and institutions, or from systems you didn't build but still have to live inside, obedience starts feeling less like submission and more like common sense. You don't question the system, you inherit it. And once it's in place, it keeps reproducing itself. That idea, that legitimacy flows downward, not upward, might be one of the oldest programs humanity ever bought into. So if kingship was an operating system installed from the top down, then the real story of civilization isn't how we learned to rule. It's how we learned to obey. And most of us never realized we were trained to. So let's slow this down for a second, not because the story isn't wild, but because this is where sloppy thinking ruins good questions. So let's be blunt. There is no archaeological evidence that the first kings literally ruled for tens of thousands of years. No skeletons, no inscriptions saying Alulim celebrated year 28,799 with cake. And scholars are very clear about this. The Sumerian king list is not a neutral history book. It's a political document, edited, redacted, rearranged. It pushes an ideology, not a stopwatch. So if someone tells you with absolute confidence that antediluvian kings were 40,000-year-old demigods who ruled the earth like Marvel villains, well, that's not research. That's fan fiction. But now let's be just as blunt about the other side, the part that gets waved away way too fast. The cities are real. Eridu, Uruk, Kish, Ur, Isin, Larsa. They existed. They're ancient. And some of them show up earlier than older linear models once liked, with more complexity than the neat, slow trial and error version is comfortable with. The post-flood section is where the list starts touching real, testable history. A lot of those later kings line up with inscriptions, with economic records, and with cross-checks between cities. Once the list crosses the flood line, it starts behaving a lot more like history than pure myth. And then you hit a name that breaks the entire argument, Enmebarajesi, a king listed right there in the same document. Except this one, we've actually found. His name shows up on real artifacts, in real temples, from his own time. So now you're stuck, because the same document that claims impossible lifespans is also naming real people, which means you don't get to dismiss it as pure myth anymore. Now, we have to explain it, because you don't accidentally preserve real names inside a completely fictional record. That shift really matters. And then there's the part nobody gets to shrug off. These texts are related. Of course they are. They come out of the same broad Mesopotamian world. But even with that on the table, they still preserve the same deep structure. Creation, cities, kingship, catastrophe, and reset. That's bigger than one scribe getting dramatic. That looks a whole lot more like a shared memory pattern. And patterns like that don't usually survive this long unless something is holding them in place. So here's the clean version. No theatrics, no incense, no chanting. We don't know if the first kings were aliens. We don't know if they were demigods. We don't know if those names were really standing in for time cycles, priesthoods, or institutions. But we do know this. Someone wanted you to believe that power didn't start with you. It started above you, from heaven, from the gods, from destiny, from the way things have always been. And that idea is far more dangerous than any giant or flying fish man. So even if every absurd lifespan is symbolic, exaggerated, or encoded, the control logic behind those symbols is very, very real. And it's still running. We grew up with a clean version of history. People come together, they figure things out, villages become towns, councils become laws. Leadership grows up from the ground just like crops. It's comforting. It makes us feel involved. But some of the oldest written receipts we have don't tell that story nearly as cleanly. They tell a stranger one. In that version, power doesn't rise, it arrives. It drops from the sky, chooses a city, installs a ruler, and everyone else just adjusts. No vote or argument. No moment where humanity says, actually, we'd like a say in this. And maybe that's the part that lingers. Not the giants or the gods. Not the impossible reign lengths carved into clay. Maybe the real secret of the Sumerian king list was never the numbers. Maybe it was the idea underneath them. That power comes from above. That your job is not to question it. Your job is to live under it. And that's why these stories still hit. Not because they're ancient, but because they're still familiar. Because once you see the pattern, power arriving from above, history written by the winners, obedience framed as destiny, you start noticing it everywhere. And that's why this matters. Not because these texts tell us exactly what happened, but because they show us how people were taught to think about power. I'm not here to tell you what to believe. I'm here to show you the receipts, ask the questions most people don't, and follow the story where it actually goes. Because the only thing more dangerous than believing the lie is never asking who needed you to. I'm Ralph. Until next time, stay curious, stay sharp, And remember, no matter what they tell you, the truth is still out there.
Hi everyone, this is James and Dan. We are two-fourths of the hit UK podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. Every week we sit down behind some microphones and share with each other the best things we've found out over the last 7 days.
Yes, so for instance, Dan, did you know that you cannot tie a knot in four dimensions?
I knew that's where I was going wrong. Interesting.
There are all sorts of reasons why, but we would go into them all on our podcast, along with loads of extra facts as well.
That's right. And if you want to check it out, No Such Thing as a Fish is available wherever you get your podcasts.
Thanks for being here tonight. If you want more stories like this, you know where to find me. You know where the links are. And if you choose to support the channel, it really helps. I'll see you next time.
Hi everyone, this is James and Dan. We are two-fourths of the hit UK podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. Every week we sit down behind some microphones and share with each other the best things we've found out over the last 7 days.
Yes, so for instance, Dan, did you know that you cannot tie a knot in four dimensions?
I knew that's where I was going wrong. Interesting.
There are all sorts of reasons why, but we would go into them all on our podcast, along with loads of extra facts as well.
That's right. And if you want to check it out, No Such Thing as a Fish is available wherever you get your podcasts.